From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Alon Ben Meir, an expert in Middle East history and politics and conflict resolution. And we're coming to you from his office in New York City. Born in Baghdad, Alon Ben Meir is a professor and senior fellow at New York University's Center for Global Affairs and senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. He specializes in international negotiations and conflict resolution. In the past two decades, Professor Ben Meir has been directly involved in various negotiations between Israel and its neighboring countries and Turkey. Ben Meir hosts a speaking series of debates and conversations with top policymakers from around the world held each semester at New York University. He has authored seven books related to the Middle East and is currently working on a new book about the psychological dimensions of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He is well known for his preeminent course on Middle East negotiations at New York University. The course covers topics such as the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Turkey's role in the Middle East, Iran's nuclear ambitions, the future for a moderate Arab center, the final status of Jerusalem, and the influence of the Gulf states. And those are some of the very topics we intend to tackle, among others, with Professor Ben Meir in this interview. Well, Alon Ben Meir, welcome to the program.
Thank you. My pleasure. My pleasure.
And thank you again for hosting us here in your office.
It's the best place, I think, for me anyway.
Professor, I want to ask you a personal question before we get started.
Sure.
I want you to talk about your history, having been born in Baghdad, your Jewish background, to the extent that actually informs how you think about many issues in the world.
Yeah, I think having born in the Middle East, in Iraq, in Baghdad, and then lived 8 years actually in the State of Israel, and maintained my studies and learning the Arabic language and, of course, the Hebrew language, it gave me a different kind of perspective about the people themselves. That is, when you study a language, it is not limited to means by which you communicate, but actually translates to culture. You understand their culture. And living with them, you begin to also understand how they think, what their habits, what they believe in, what they disavow, and specifically their mindset. That is, what is the psychological dimension of their being as such? Understanding that, I think, gave me the opportunity to begin to look at conflicts in the Middle East in particular from a different perspective. That is, when I look at various conflicts today throughout the region, I think one thing is missing, and that is not understanding the psychological dimension behind these conflicts. And it is missing even by policymakers, which is really most unfortunate. That is, the policymakers, be that in the United States, European communities, certainly the Arab state, and even Israel, they do not understand that if you do not make a supreme effort to mitigate psychological aspect of any conflict, you are not going to be able to solve that conflict. If you look at the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, it's a good example. You cannot get the two people to sit down and begin to negotiate and resolve their conflicting issues. If you don't understand the history of the conflict, if you don't understand the religious dimension of the conflict, if you don't understand the ideological foundation that brought them to this point, lack of understanding of this issue is not going to resolve the problem of the Palestinian, certainly not going to provide Israel with the security it seeks. Certainly there'll be no solution to the future of Jerusalem, because these differences are embedded not in terms of territory alone, but in terms of the historical narrative and what both people believe. And these set of beliefs are in contradiction.
Now, let me remind our listeners that you are a prolific presence on Twitter. You tweet at Alon Ben Meir, and one of your tweets, you say, traditional way of approaching Israeli-Palestinian conflict must be abandoned in favor of reconciliation process preceding resumption of talks. We witnessed not too long ago, Secretary of State John Kerry, a couple of years ago, tried to resume the talks. That failed. So what do you mean by the fact that we need to abandon this traditional approach in favor of reconciliation? What would that consist of concretely?
Yeah. That is, reconciliation is a process needed to precede formal negotiations, which means if I looked at the reasons why past negotiations have failed. And when you look at it very carefully, you come back to the point I just made earlier. Neither side consider the aspect, what are the real historical differences, religious dimension of that conflict, and what they have imparted to the public. What they have done, both of them, they have passed their historic victimization to the next generation, the next generation. So for example, the Israelis continue to educate and make sure that every young girl and boy understand the Holocaust. And so when you talk to a boy 5 or 10 years old today in Israel, they will speak about the Holocaust as if they have experienced it themselves. If you speak to a Palestinian the same age, they will speak about the Nakba, the catastrophe of 1948, as if they were themselves the refugees. What I'm suggesting to you then, you have created a generational mindset, a sense of victimization, which means if you want now to restart the negotiation, you're going to have to get the people to change their attitude, not just the politician. If the politicians agree today to resolve many of these issues, the public is not prepared to accept these dramatic changes. For example, Netanyahu keeps saying Jerusalem will remain indivisible, united city of the state of Israel, period. But we also know that no solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict can be achieved unless Jerusalem becomes a capital of two states. The Palestinians insist, the right of return of the Palestinians. We know that is not going to happen. Israel cannot afford to absorb 3 or 4 million people. It will lose its national identity. It will lose the only refuge that the Jews have today, which is in Israel. So if you don't mitigate this kind of mindset, if you do not change the narrative on both sides simultaneously, and if you don't begin measures people to people, mutual tourism, discussion of these conflicting issues by the academic community, changing textbooks, you have to take activities on the ground between people to people and government to government. We're not talking about concessions now, just so that you begin to mitigate the psychological impediment of the conflict first. And when you prepare the people to the change, the impending change, they will be able to accept it.
It doesn't seem like the leaders on either side are prepared to do that. They don't seem to have the political will to do that.
Absolutely, they are not prepared to do that. They are not even thinking in those terms. And I must tell you, without mentioning names, I'm in touch with various governments in the EU on a regular basis.
And the EU?
With the EU, who are now thinking in terms specifically by the French to have an international conference to resume the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. And I was very clear that if you do so, it's a recipe for failure. Because if you merely start now getting, even if you could get them to get together and sit down and start negotiation, and even if they agree on certain issue, it's not going to fly. You're going to have to get the people to support this kind of peace process. And the people are not there yet. Yes, they will tell you we want a two-state solution. But when you hear Netanyahu, is he really prepared to settle for a two-state solution? I do not believe that for a moment. And look what, if you recall what Abbas was saying, not only that he is not willing to negotiate without certain preconditions, but he went back to the 1917, to the Balfour Declaration, reigniting something, and he demanding from Britain to apologize now for what happened 100 years ago. So what actually is happening, we're going backwards. Netanyahu, in his speech at the General Assembly, made the same thing. This is our land. We are not occupying power. Abraham came to this land. So he's going back to reiterate historic narrative that is not consistent with the requirement for peace. And that means making the kind of concession that need to be done. And so the public is not there. And certainly the leadership are making every effort to, instead of modifying the public opinion, they're making it much worse.
Well, it doesn't sound very optimistic. And you had said that in one of your tweets that you think that the French initiative to resume talks is a positive thing, but what you're saying is it's necessary but not sufficient unless they have these people-to-people types of measures.
It has to follow these people-to-people measures. If you look at the Kurdish-Turkish conflict...
You just read my mind. I was going to ask you about that.
Well, here's another example. Think in those terms. There was a Kurdistan at one point. It lasted 2 years, between 1922 and 1924. Kurds that currently are divided between Syria, Iraq, Turkey, and Iran. Now, they were not divided in 1922. But then the victorious powers, the French and the British, came in and very arbitrarily divided the Middle East on a map, irrespective of ethnicity, irrespective of history, irrespective of culture, irrespective of anything else. Basically, look at the map, and this is Iraq, and appointed a king, and this is Syria, and this is Lebanon. So it was all self-serving, chopping the region, disregarding what this region is all about. And so what you have now, Kurdish people, from that day on, they have never forgotten what happened to them. They have their own culture. They have their own language. They have own traditions. And the moment they felt they had an opportunity to begin to revive their cultural heritage, they've done so. Look what happened in Iraq.
Northern Iraq.
They move on toward autonomous rule. In that case, the United States was very helpful. They imposed no-fly zone, preventing Saddam Hussein from further attacking and poisoning the Kurds in Iraq. And today they are, for all intents and purposes, almost an independent country. In Iran, they have officially been given equal right, politically speaking, but they've been also discriminated against. And now you have the Iranian Kurds who have risen against the government, and they're attacking the Revolutionary Guard because they also want some kind of better treatment. And it will be only a question of time when they will rise and would demand their own autonomous rule.
And do you think they should have their own state? Professor?
Well, you know, it is not whether they shouldn't. Or why shouldn't they, you have to ask. That is, it's not for me to decide they should have it. If you go back to Turkey and the Kurds, this is a much more pronounced conflict. Here, in my conversation with the scores of Turkish parliamentarians, both Kurds as well as Turk, and I have not found a single one who said, Kurd, who said, we want complete independence. What they are saying, we want some kind of autonomy. We want to live our life. How can we be prevented from using our language? How can we be prevented from passing on our tradition, our way of life, the way we eat, the way we dress, the way we think? We want to be remaining Turks. We'll maintain our nationality as such. But if Erdogan and his successor are claiming that Turkey is a democracy, well, within the confines of a democracy, we should have the right to live our life as we see fit. So therefore, what you have here, this new awakening, specifically with the eruption of the Arab Spring, and those minorities, these ethnic groups throughout the Middle East, are saying to themselves, our time has come. And you're going to see, if we're talking about the Kurds, in all four countries, beginning to see when to exploit this opportunity. Well, I'm not going to suggest to you that they are ready to reform the historic Kurdistan, because there's huge differences.
Exactly.
And political, social, economic, between the four groups, and even differences within, say, the Iraqi Kurdish autonomous rule between the two major big families. But the Kurds will no longer accept subjugation by any of the host countries. And the sooner Erdogan and Khomeini and others come to this realization, the better, the faster you will find a solution.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our special guest is Alon Ben-Meir. He's professor and senior fellow at New York University's Center for Global Affairs and senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. We're coming to you from his office in New York City. I'm Carol Castiel, and this is a reminder that our Press Conference USA is also available online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Abdelkarim Bouragoua from Saleh, Morocco. And we always love hearing from you. Tell us what insights you're gleaning from our conversation with Professor Ben-Meir. Write to us at PCUSA at voanews.com. Tell us your name, where you're from, and how you listen to the program. Or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our guest, Professor Alon Ben-Meir, here in New York City. Professor, you've written so eloquently about many other topics. Let's turn now to the terrible conflict in Syria. It's absolutely devastating to see what is going on. You have tweeted about this. One of them is massive number of deaths and injuries in Syria should shame every leader who stands by Assad in the face of his wanton slaughter of innocents. And yet, that seems to be what is going on. The United States ostensibly backs the mainstream opposition against Bashar al-Assad, who is backed to the hilt by Russia, by Iran, and many other Shiite militias. You have the mainstream opposition weakening by the day, becoming either more radicalized or finding the need to affiliate with the much more extremist groups on the ground because they are more powerful, they get more weapons, and they are still bent and determined to defeat or weaken Bashar al-Assad. And yet, he is being strengthened by Russia, by Iran, and it doesn't seem like the United States, the international community, is doing anything. So you have this very much polarized situation, and yet innocents are being killed, children, refugees flowing out. We have the most serious refugee crisis since World War II, much of which is because of this horrible conflict.
And absolutely. You know, recently I wrote a piece called A Moral Outrageousness That Enrages No One, in reference to Syria. And here we are more than 70 years after World War II. It would have been inconceivable. You know, when the United Nations was created, one of the main purposes was that to prevent these type of atrocities that we have seen during World War II, never to allow it to happen again. And here we are witnessing day in and day out the systematic destruction of a country and the systematic slaughter of innocent people. Most people cannot imagine when you have more than 500,000 dead and nearly more than 1 million injured, 11 million people either internally displaced or become refugees. In total, that represents more than half of the Syrian population. This is not just a bloody conflict. This is a calamity. And here we have an international community basically watching, almost complacent. And I'm missing almost complacent. Yes, there is an effort by the United States, by Saudi Arabia, by others to try to help the rubble, to undermine Assad. But all of these efforts were half measures, often late also. Not sufficient enough early on to make any real dent when there was an opportunity to make such a dent. What we have done, basically relinquished, and I'm talking about the United States in particular, relinquish our moral responsibility in that regard and allow actually Russia and Iran to have a free hand to do whatever they wanted to do in Syria. And only with the rises of ISIS, we, the United States and other powers, including the Russian and others, decided, well, we have now to focus on ISIS. But for Russia, while they are focusing on ISIS, they did not abandon and they continue to support even much more so Assad, because just like the Iranian, Assad for them is very important to maintain their regional interests and their regional influence. Let me give you an example why Iran is so committed to Assad. Iran has a great ambition to become the region hegemon. And they have today basically control over a crescent extending from the Gulf to the Mediterranean. They have a huge influence in Iraq. They have had and continue to have huge influence in Syria. They have a huge influence through Hezbollah in Lebanon. They do not want to lose that link. If they lose Syria, their influence in Syria, well, the entire crescent will no longer be contiguous. And they're going to fight to the last Syrian soldier or to the last Syrian civilian, for that matter, to maintain their influence from the Mediterranean to the Gulf. For Russia, they have had for a long time a naval base. And they want to continue their influence. When Russia realizes a vacuum that was created by the United States, we leave it to Putin to take full advantage of that and jump into the region with far greater force. And now Russia become indispensable a player. That is, if there is going to be any solution, it cannot be found unless Russia goes along with it, even much more so than Iran.
Well, Professor, many voices called for the United States, the so-called friends of Syria, to intervene earlier in order to prevent exactly what we're seeing. And of course, others, particularly the Obama administration, says, well, they sort of explain, well, even if we did, it wouldn't have helped. We probably wouldn't have made a difference. And of course, this is up for debate, you know, the so-called red line incident. Many analysts have said, observers said that if the Obama administration, along with the French and others who were willing, had done surgical airstrikes on Assad's air force, that would have sent a very important signal. But instead, we ceded, in a sense, to Russia. We had this so-called chemical weapons deal. And yet, we're still seeing chemical weapons in the region. We still see Bashar al-Assad using barrel bombs filled with chlorine gas. And I wouldn't be surprised if the mustard gas that some of these ISIS groups are getting may be passed on by the Assad government, because they really are two sides of the same coin. Bashar al-Assad says often, you know, it's either us, you know, me or ISIS. But of course, that's a false choice. But again, we're not seeing enough support over the years being given to the mainstream rebels, to the civilian opposition. So the question now is, it does seem that the community, the international community, has basically just thrown up its arms. And yet you write recently that notwithstanding, I'm quoting you, notwithstanding the presidential election, the United States cannot afford to relinquish its moral leadership. And at a minimum, you're advising the Obama administration to send a clear and unambiguous message to Assad by undertaking a surgical bombing of Syria's airfields, some of its Air Force installations. First of all, do you think that is even feasible given, you know, the mindset of President Obama leaving office? And even if it was, is it too late?
I don't think it's too late. And this is actually the legacy that Obama is going to take with him, that he basically was watching for more than 5 years the systematic destruction of a country and pretty much did not lift a finger. No, it's not too late. And it's, as a matter of fact, when you talk to people that support Hillary Clinton and those who support Trump today, they both would have supported surgical strike. Look what happened when the ceasefire was agreed upon. I wrote a piece that this ceasefire will not hold. And it didn't hold. So my suggestion was surgical would mean one thing very critically important, and that is preventing Assad from dropping these barrel bombs that are killing indiscriminately men, women, and children by the hundreds, by the thousands. That would have sent that kind of message. And I'm the last person would suggest send American troops to Syria, because that is not the answer. What happened with the chemical deal you mentioned, in and of itself, was a good deal. But what it did also paralyzed President Obama. So by making that deal and by retracting his position in terms of allowing Assad to cross the red line by using chemical weapon and did nothing about it, he basically signaled to Russia, to Iran, to Assad himself, that you can go ahead and do pretty much what you want to do. We took your chemical weapons, and that you're free to do. And it's exactly what they have done. And this is not acceptable. This is in many ways undermined, not just Obama as a president, but the standing of the United States, as the leader of the free world. This is very significant. The United States, as the global leader, cannot afford that kind of setback. The irony, you know, you have President Bush who came in like a cowboy charging with two guns, go to Iraq, where he had no business to go there, and destroy another country, change the entire dynamics internally, brought in the Shiite, suppressing the Sunnis, and Iraq continued to be in the civil war, except no one is talking about it. Do you know that roughly 1,000 Iraqis are getting killed every single month between the Sunni and the Shiite? And who's talking about it? So he dismantled the whole country. So Obama came to this, doesn't really want to follow suit. He said, well, I don't want to get involved in another conflict in the Middle East because look what happened to us with what President Bush has done. But then as a president, as the leader of the free world, you cannot swing from the extreme left to the extreme right. Had Obama kept his word and did something when Assad crossed that red line, the dynamics today in the conflict, the war in Syria, would have been completely different.
Professor Ben Meir, as we close, perhaps we could go back to your native Iraq and have you talk about the situation there. And speaking of Iran, Iran has so much influence They did, actually, even after the U.S.-led invasion in 2003, they were lying in wait, which was, again, a miscalculation on the part of George W. Bush. But some analysts say, too, that President Obama perhaps miscalculated. Perhaps we didn't do enough to prevent the Shia regime of Nouri al-Maliki from pretty much suppressing the Sunni, who now, many of them going into the arms of ISIS, not because they want to, but because they fear the Shiite militias more than the Sunni extremists. And so now we have these efforts to counter, to retake Mosul, to try to destroy the so-called Islamic State. But these are all sort of military operations. Your final thoughts on what needs to be done to, on the one hand, defeat this scourge of the so-called Islamic State, but also take into consideration the provocations by Shia militias, even backed by Iran, that as long as they also are active, we'll continue to have a Shia-Sunni split, tensions, and even, you know, an Arab-Persian tensions throughout the region, from Iraq to Syria to Yemen.
I'm glad you raised this question, because this is a very important part of the puzzle that is impacting the region and will continue to impact the region for years, if not decades to come. What we have done in Iraq was disastrous, not for just the Sunni community in Iraq. Remember this, when Iraq was established in 1922, the Sunnis ruled Iraq since then for 81 years, albeit they were the minority. The Truman Doctrine was, all along, is to mutual containment, to contain both Iraq and Iran, not to allow either side to have the upper hand. What President Bush has done in his wisdom came in and completely changed the entire dynamic. And that is, by going to Iraq, dismantling the country, and introducing so-called democracy, which we are so naive thinking this is the recipe that the Arab world needs today, brought in the Shiite to power. The Shiite are a decisive majority in Iraq.
And were oppressed.
And they were oppressed. And so for them, you know, revenge, retribution is very much of the culture. And I'm not demeaning that, but it's a part of a culture. And so what they have done, Maliki began to consolidate his power at the expense of the Sunnis, persecuting the Sunnis, removing them from position of power, completely segregating, discriminating against them, to a point where they have basically given up in despair. Now what happens? Saudi Arabia, the Gulf state, the Sunni Arab state, who are fighting to maintain their strength, their position in the region, Iran being a Shiite, Saudi Arabia being a Sunni state by and large, both are now fighting for regional hegemony, which means the Sunni-Shiite bloodshed that's taking place today, I can assure you, is going to be there for years to come. Now, let me go back to your question in terms of what will be with the Sunnis. I believe that ISIS will be defeated, physically will be defeated. Ideologically, no. That's going to take years, if ever. But the way to do so, you need to make sure that the Sunnis, who are partly supporting ISIS today, they see a horizon for themselves. In my view, the only way you're going to be able to get the Sunnis in Iraq to join together is by offering them autonomous rule in their own three provinces. As long as you can find equitable distribution of oil revenue, that's what's going to be necessary. But I can assure you, as long as the Sunnis do not know what's the prospect going to be once ISIS is defeated, they will have no reason whatsoever to continue their fight both against the Shiite. That's not going to happen. So for the United States, I've been advising all along, start conversation with the Sunnis. You want to defeat ISIS, that's great. Everybody wants to defeat ISIS. It will be defeated sooner or later. But if you want to end the conflict in Iraq, which is central, begin to have that dialogue with the Sunnis and, you know, give them the opportunity to consolidate themselves and establish their own autonomous rule along the line of the Kurds have. Iraq can no longer be pieced together. So this is where we are today in the region.
Alon Ben-Meir is an expert on Middle East politics. He specializes in international negotiations and conflict resolution at New York University. Professor, thank you so much for a terrific conversation.
My pleasure, anytime.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in New York City and Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Dan Brody. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.